I must say it's a little bit of a miracle that I'm here today for two reasons. First, there was a strike in Argentina on Wednesday, so I did not know whether I could fly, and I arrived last night, luckily. The strike was, stopped. And third, and perhaps more weirdly, it's a bit strange, if not miraculous. Argentine, located at UK non-Catholic University, was asked to speak on Aquinas, on miracles at the Angelicum, where we have all these Dominicans who probably know by far more than I do on this. But anyway, thank you, Marius, for being a good secondary course, allowing the primary course to act through you and get me here. Okay, so when one is set to investigate the nature and workings of miracles, one can either take a philosophical approach or a theological approach. Thus, for the former, one would ask whether a miracle is possible at all. What should the nature of such an event be? How this event might come about? And such sort of questions. For the latter, on the contrary, one would ask what the theological significance of such event is and why they would happen. That is, what is the ultimate end or goal of a miracle in relation to the salvation of human beings? There's an ongoing debate on whether Aquinas' considerations on miracles refers mostly to the philosophical or to the theological approach, and I will not delve into such a debate. I will focus, however, on Aquinas' philosophical comments on miracles, as to unpack the metaphysical toolbox he uses to solve the basic question about miracles. How are they possible? Aquinas deals with miracles in what might seem strange or even odd ways for modern readers. In almost all places when he discusses miracles, he does so asking whether God can do things outside the order of natural things without using the terminology of miracles. And later he asks whether this action could be called miracles. This strategy is in the Summa Contra Gentiles, in the questions of the power of God, and in the Summa Theologiae. So in a way, he follows a similar strategy to when dealing with the existence and the nature of God. He first asks the ansit question, followed by the quid est question. In fact, what we would call the definition of a miracle starts in Aquinas with an etymological analysis of the term. Now, another interesting general, though not unimportant, feature is that he places the treatment of miracles within his doctrine of divine providence, rather than within the epistemological considerations, like philosophers of a more Humean ilk would do, or within treatises of natural philosophy, as most early 20th century neo-Thomists would do. But I would later discuss that. So for Aquinas, the most important and appropriate place to discuss the possibility of miracles is when discussing the power of God and how God acts in nature, always placing his ideas after his treatment of God acting as primary cause in the coursing of all natural causes, and before his treatment of how God uses higher causes, such as spiritual substances, to govern over creation. I will focus my analysis on his discussion within the question on the power of God. And this work is certainly of maturity and expands more on the arguments than the Summa Theologiae. Aquinas is quite adamant about the possibility of God acting besides the natural causes. In his first assertion, he has no quarrel in claiming that there is no doubt about it. The argument is quite simple. If God is the omnipotent creator of all that is, then God can certainly perform new things in nature that appear to be contrary to or besides the order he has established by creation, simply because he has established that order and is not subject to it. The main goal of this talk will be to elucidate as much as possible this simple statement. For doing so, I will show how Aquinas' understanding of miracles is deeply connected with his metaphysical doctrine of providence, which sets the terms for discussing God's actions. Additionally, I will analyze Aquinas' use of a particular metaphysical notion that he introduces to speak of the possibility of miracles, namely that of obediential potency, a notion that is at the base of all of his considerations on miracles. But first, I will present a brief overview of the typical Thomist account. As I said, Aquinas places his discussion of miracles after his presentation of the doctrine of providence, as a sort of corollary to it, or better, as another way that God has to guide creation to the ends he intends for it. For Aquinas, a miracle is an act of God that goes besides or beyond the natural created causes, praeter causas naturales. This simple and preliminary definition already shows that Aquinas' own understanding is deeply rooted in the intimate and ultimate dependence of creatures upon God. To show that God can actually do things besides the natural created order, he argues that if one accepts, one, that God is the author of being, esse, in all created things, two, that God is provident with respect to each created thing, and three, that he does not act out of natural necessity, that is, God's actions are free, it follows that God can act independently of the cause of nature in the production of particular effects. Aquinas is quick to remind the reader that God's providence extends to everything and each thing in particular. Each individual thing, together with its powers, is created, sustained in existence, and moved towards its particular operation through God's providential action, a doctrine to which I shall refer in a few minutes. In addition, Aquinas reminds the reader that God's actions are not out of the necessity, but according to his free will. Thus, God could act beyond the natural causes, either regarding being, by producing in natural things a new form that nature is unable to produce, or by producing a form in a particular manner, a sight in a blind man, or regarding operation, by restraining the action of nature from doing what it would naturally do. For Aquinas, when God does something besides the order of nature, he does not put aside the entire order of the universe, but the order of some particular cause to its particular effect. Now, since the cause of the order of all things, absolutely speaking, is God, there is nothing that prevents God from being able to do what is possible to natural efficient causes in their own order, as long as these actions are not impossible in themselves. When treating the same topic in the Summa Theologiae, Aquinas considers a slightly different question that goes directly to this point. In this case, instead of asking whether God can do something beyond natural causes, he asks whether God can act beyond the order intrinsic to natural things. Praeter ordinem rebus inditum. Aquinas affirms that the different kinds of orders proceed from different kinds of causes, and thus there would be as many orders as kinds of causes, a distinction through which he refers to the difference between primary and secondary causes. Since secondary causes depend upon the primary cause, the order is dependent upon the order that proceeds from the primary cause. Thus, if one considers the order that proceeds from the primary cause, then God cannot act against it, because he would be acting against his own nature. If, however, one considers the order that proceeds from secondary causes, then God could act beyond or besides it, because this order depends upon God as a cause. Ultimately, God is not subject to this secondary natural order, but on the contrary, this order is subject to God. Thus, if God wanted to establish a new one, there would be no contradiction whatsoever. In fact, Aquinas further argues that God does not create or make everything he can, meaning that God could do things that are not yet done in what he had already done. Furthermore, Aquinas adds that nothing appears to prohibit the existence of a passive potency that could be actualized by different efficient causes, that is, a natural cause or the divine cause, or even the existence of a created passive potency that can only be actualized by the power of God. This kind of potency is what he had previously called obediential potency, by which every creature would obey its creator. Thus, although there is an order from a natural cause to its natural effect, there is also a previous order through which the creature depends upon its creator. Ultimately, for Aquinas, since God has the power to do everything that does not imply contradiction, and that there is a particular potency towards act in creatures, God can make this potency to be actualized without any natural created means. I will analyze this obediential potency in more detail a bit later. Now, Aquinas also recognizes that miracles are in a way performed by rational beings other than God, namely spiritual beings and human beings. Now, these are always because of a gratuitous grace that God gives, gratia gratis data. In fact, miracles performed by rational creatures only happen because of God's power. In the Summa Theologiae, after the treatment of virtues and vices that are pertinent to all human beings, Aquinas discusses the different graces that God offers to some people. Among these graces, Aquinas deals with the grace of prophecy, of rapture, the grace of tongues, of speaking with science and wisdom, and finally, with the gratuitous grace of performing miracles. It is rather interesting for us today that Aquinas makes explicit mention of God acting through a secondary cause, as in the case of regular divine providence. I'm quoting now, God is the principal cause, for he uses instrumentally either man's inward movement or his speech or some outward action or the bodily contact or even a dead body. That's in the Summa Secunda Secunda. In fact, when explaining how the sacraments work, Aquinas also makes use of the analogy of a principal agent using an instrumental through which the principal agent accomplishes something that goes beyond the nature of the instrument. Thus, recalling the general doctrine of providence will aid us in understanding this seemingly odd statement. When explaining the metaphysics of the doctrine of providence, Aquinas argues for four different ways in which God's causality penetrates most intimately the causality of created natural things. And hence, he is said to be provident with respect to the whole of creation, both universally and particularly. The first two ways, I termed the foundational moments, refer to the creation and conservation of natural things and their powers. Since all powers of any created efficient cause whatsoever are from God, then God is said to cause every action of created things, because he gives natural things the powers by which they are able to act. As well, God is said to be the cause of an action by upholding the created natural power in its being, as in the constant participation of God's being in the creature. God not only gave existence to things when they first began to exist, but preserves them in existence. Thus, God is always preserving those powers in them and hence causing them to be. This simply means that if this divine preservation were to cease, every natural causation would also cease. And therefore, every natural cause or power of a thing finds its ultimate cause in God's causality in this second sense as well. I have termed the second two moments the dynamic moments of God's providence. Remember, I said there were four. The explanation of these dynamic moments depends on how Aquinas understands the workings of an instrumental cause and will be the key to understanding the gratuitous grace of working a miracle, as he uses this analogy to explain both divine providence and this particular grace, as well as the grace in the sacraments. For Aquinas, an instrument, when being used as an instrument, has two different effects. one that pertains to it according to its own nature, and one that pertains to it insofar as it is being used by the primary cause, with the latter transcending the nature of the instrument. It is through the first effect, however, that which pertains to the instrument, that the second effect, that which is according to the principal cause, is performed. So the first effect is required in the doctrine of providence to perform the second effect. And hence the use of this and not another instrument. Still, neither effect could be caused by the instrument if not by the causing of the principal cause. Thus both effects are said to belong both to the instrument and to the principal cause. Now these effects refer to each of the two dynamic moments of the regular divine providence. Thus the first of these two ways of causing refers to the first effect of an instrumental cause in the following way. Every created cause performs its operation according to its own nature and powers, moved by God to act and to achieve its proper effect. For instance, when someone uses the sharpness of a knife to cut a loaf of bread to make toast, the first effect would be the very cutting of the knife. The second way of causing the action of the instrument refers to producing an effect that goes beyond the power of a particular created cause. The second effect would be, for instance, cutting the loaf of bread in a particular shape, which is something that the knife by itself cannot do. As a father of three small children, if I don't cut my child bread in a star or in such a that way, I am in big trouble. So, and the knife cannot do that. It's only by my action that my child doesn't put me in trouble. Anyway, therefore, God is the cause of everything's action inasmuch as first, he gives everything the power to act. A second, preserves that power in being. Third, apply it to action. And fourth, inasmuch as by his power, every other power acts. So the foundational and the dynamic moments of divine providence. Yeah? At least the metaphysical side of divine providence. Now, in miracles, God utilizes this or that instrument, this or that person, not to accomplish the second effect through accomplishing the first effect, because the second effect is not accomplished through the natural created power at all, as in the case of regular divine providence. Rather, the effect that goes beyond the natural power is produced by God's power alone. Thus, Aquinas expands his own understanding of divine providence through instrumental causation, explaining that the second effect, that which goes beyond the actual power of the instrumental cause, is achieved by an extra power received in the instrumental cause from the principal agent. See what he has to say in the questions on the power of God. Human and angelic spirits act somewhat as instruments of the divine power for the accomplishment of a miracle. This does not mean that they are possessed of a permanent habitual power, since they would be able to work miracles whenever they choose to do so. The power to cooperate with God in the working of a miracle may be taken to be something after the manner of imperfect forms I called intentions, which are not permanent and are only evoked at the presence of the principal agent. When dealing with the sacrament of the Eucharist, Aquinas uses similar language, explaining how the instrument receives a new power at the moment of consecration of the bread and wine for them to become the body and blood of Christ. Since these words of the consecration are uttered in the person of Christ, it is from his command that they receive their instrumental power from him. My point here is that when dealing with miracles, Aquinas speaks not of the two effects that an instrument causes by the power of the principal agent, as it happens in regular divine providence, but of a new power that the instrument receives from the principal agent by which the instrument causes instrumentally an effect that is by no means proportionate to its natural causal powers. In regular divine providence, even if Aquinas speaks of the principal agent causing an effect that goes beyond the created causal power of secondary causes, the second effect is, in a way, proportionate to the first effect, which pertains to the secondary cause by nature. Thus, for instance, when cutting a cake in the shape of a star, the principal agent requires the sharpness of the knife to accomplish the star-shaped cake. In this case, both effects are produced through the causal power of the instrument. In miracles, however, the principal agent, God, by his power alone, given to an instrument as a gratuitous grace, causes effects that are in no way proportionate to the natural causal power of the instrument. The image might not be the best example, as we've just heard. I should change that, actually. Well, it depends how we interpret biblical miracles, right? All right. Now, how can created beings receive such power from God through which God produces miracles using created beings as instruments for it? Is there some kind of disposition in created things that allows for receiving such grace? Aquinas explains in his commentary to Peter Lombard's Sentences that the very possibility of receiving this grace, or of this receiving of a new transient power, arises from that obediential potency of which I spoke a few moments ago. No creature can produce things which are above nature as a principal agent. But a creature can produce them acting as an instrumental agent moved by the uncreated power. For there is an obediential potency in creatures, so that whatever the creator predisposed may be done in it and through it, that is, in and through the creature, which is the nature of being an instrument. This obediential potency appears all throughout Aquinas' works, mostly when discussing miracles or other graces that God imparts on human beings or spiritual substances, like the grace of prophecy, for instance. For example, when discussing whether faith can make a man to work miracles in the questions of the power of God, Aquinas states that holy men are set to work miracles, not as though they were the chief authors of miracles, but because as divine instruments they announce, as it were, to natural things the divine command, which nature obeys when miracles are wrought. So, what is this potency to obey God that is in natural things? In a nutshell, it is nothing more than a metaphysical inclination to receive from and respond to God whatever God wants to offer, or to request from the creature. Ultimately, by being the creator, God owns creation, and so he can give more to creation than what he had given so far. This metaphysical inclination is called obediential potency. Miracles, then, are rooted in the very metaphysical constitution of creatures, and as such, are deemed possible both from the perspective of the creator, given God's infinite power, and from the perspective of the creature, given this inclination inherent to the being a creature. Obediential potency, thus, by opening the possibility for creatures to be transformed by the power of God, accounts for God's working beyond, besides, above, or contrary, the cause of the natural causal order. To elucidate further this metaphysical notion, Aquinas explains that there are two kinds of passive potencies in creatures. There is first a natural passive potency that corresponds to the natures of created things, which is proportionate to natural agents. This natural passive potency is limited by the nature of finite creatures. The second passive potency is only proportionate to the first cause, namely God, who who is the only one that can actualize this potency, making a creature to be higher than its own nature. In Aquinas' own words, in every creature there is a double passive potency, one in comparison with a natural agent, the other in comparison with the first agent, which can reduce any creature to a higher act than a natural agent can reduce. And this is usually called the obediential potency of nature. This twofold distinction that Aquinas brings to the metaphysical discussion table refers to the two different kinds of causes, namely created causes and the uncreated cause. Obediential potency refers only to the latter and cannot be actualized by the former. In this sense, obediential potency is not a passive potency in reference to the nature or the essence of creatures by being this or that creature, and hence it is not a natural passive potency. Thus, natural causes cannot act upon it. And just as a reflection as a father, this is why parents don't own children. They don't obey us, you see? Sorry. Well, not always. It is a passive potency that exists only in relation to God, as the only agent who can reduce it to act. As there is a natural passive potency for natural changes, so there is an obediential potency for miraculous conversions, Aquinas says. Now, in the disputed questions on truth, he says that this obediential potency cannot be reduced in its totality, since God's power is infinite, while natural passive potencies can be fulfilled in their totality. In a way, thus, this obediential potency is an unlimited passive potency in comparison to God's unlimited power. And for the Star Wars fans around, this unlimited power is certainly greater than that of the Emperor. Sorry. So given that the only agent can reduce the creature's obediential potency to act is God, this passive potency is in creatures so that God can perform miracles. Thus, this obediential potency allows God to actualize creatures into any effect capable of being produced by the divine power. In this sense, obediential potency finds its limits only in the power of God and in what can bring about without contradiction. Now, this is a passive potency found in every creature, as I said, not due to its own essence of being this or that creature, but simply by being a creature. That is, by the very fact of being created, every being includes in it its own essence, this passive obediential potency. This argument helps to see where this potency resides in the metaphysical constitution of beings. Clearly, it cannot reside in the creature's esse, for it is a passive potency, and esse is the principle of actuality in things. So it must reside in the creature's essence. But again, not due to being this or that particular kind of creature, but by being a creature simpliciter. Now, since obediential potency is in every creature for the very fact of being a creature, it is the whole creature that is lifted by God's power when God performs a miracle, by receiving in its totality what God wishes. In the whole creature, in tota creatura, there is a certain obediential potency by which the whole creature, again, tota creatura, obeys God in order to receive in itself whatever God wills. Again, this means that the essence or nature of the thing does not limit God's action in it, but rather that the creature is always open to God's bestowing of his infinite power over it, obediently receiving what God wants to share. Now, I mentioned in passing at the opening of this talk that Aquinas deals with the question of miracles in almost all places within the doctrine of providence, as another way in which God has to guide in creation, and in particular the church, to God's glory. I also mentioned that several early 20th century neo-Thomists, possibly in an attempt to engage with modern thought, and in particular with the theme of the laws of nature, tend to place the treatment of miracles within the volumes of natural philosophy, far from the doctrine of providence. Aquinas does make a succinct link between miracles and the laws of nature, although his understanding of the laws of nature is rather different than what it meant in the early 20th century. In fact, in Aquinas' Aristotelian worldview, the notion of the laws of nature played a rather minor role, if it played one at all. It is a commonplace today in the historiography of the notion of the laws of nature to argue that before Descartes, even though the phrase was widespread, used throughout Europe, it vaguely expressed more than regularities in nature. Early modern law... Oh, look, I missed all that. Sorry, those are nice images. Anyway, early modern laws of nature were explanatory, codified, discrete, mathematical, and causal. Thus, Descartes had his three laws of motion, as Newton did after him. Now, these features translated almost unchanged until the early decades of the past century, but were absent in Aquinas's 13th century philosophy of nature. The key to this lack of usage is to be found in the fact that pre-Cartesian Aristotelian model of philosophy of nature had no need for such a notion, mainly due to the primacy given to the concept of formal cause. Formal causes explained the behaviors of natural things, and so there was no need for a separate notion, such as the laws of nature, to explain this behavior. In a world filled with formal causes, the very meaning of the laws of nature ruling the behavior of things was almost empty. And hence this notion was not a significant part of the mostly Aristotelian philosophical system. Consider how Aquinas uses the term laws of nature when discussing the Eucharist in one of the last things he wrote in his Summa, which is, as it happens, one of the few instances he uses the term applied to the behavior of natural things and not of human beings. I quote, "Every change made according to the laws of nature is a formal change," he said, implying an identification of the terminology with that of formal causation. For Aquinas, thus, the notion of the laws of nature, if at all useful in his metaphysical system, was nothing but a metaphor to refer to formal causality. A metaphor brought from the realm of human behavior, which is ruled by natural law, which is the particular participation of the divine law in the hearts of human beings. In fact, when discussing what is necessary for human beings to receive a law from God to guide their actions in the Summa Contra Gentiles, Aquinas opposes the behavior of irrational creatures to that of human beings, explaining that the former, irrational creatures, are guided through a natural inclination that follows their species, that is, the final causes that follow the formal cause. Even when Aquinas brings this notion into the discussion of miracles in the questions on the power of God, he is quick to make a similar suggestion, stating that the law of nature, in singular, refers to the internal order of creation. Now, after the dismissal of this Aristotelian worldview during the 16th and 17th centuries, a new image of nature replaced it, namely a corpuscular conception of nature that required a mechanistic explanation. This new view of nature entailed that there are insensibly small portions of matter that are indivisible, as far as natural processes are concerned, with nothing but shape, size, and changeable degree of motion and rest. The whole material world was thus reducible to and arose because of the arrangement and motions of the underlying atoms, which, lacking formal causes, had no powers of their own. They only had movement. These atoms, however, behaved regularly. Their movements were describable with precise mathematical formulations. These formulations were, for Descartes, Newton, and the like, the very laws of nature, laws that were imposed on nature by the most perfect lawgiver. God. If there were laws of nature, then there was a divine lawgiver in charge of the created order. If one considers this historical birth of the notion of the laws of nature, one sees that this notion is alien to the thought of a medieval thinker like Aquinas. And thus, it might seem odd that Thomist thinkers feel compelled to bring it into their own treatises and handbooks. Still, by the early 20th century, this notion was so engraved in the view of nature, and not least importantly, was used to deny the very possibility of miracles by the followers of Hume, that Thomist scholars faced the challenge of addressing this issue. As it is well known, a plethora of textbooks on Thomist philosophy appeared after Pope Leo XIII's 1879 encyclical Eterni Patris, giving a new life to the Thomist school. The most important call that Pope Leo expressed in this letter was the renewal of Christian philosophy by the profound study of the thought of Thomas Aquinas for the profit of the Catholic Church and the whole society. One may find even today works of this like. Among these, many discuss the possibility of miracles in direct reference to the modern notion of the laws of nature within the treatise of natural philosophy. See, for instance, one of the most renowned of Thomist handbooks, Joseph Gretz's Elementa Philosophia Aristotelico Thomistica. I think that's the first edition. In its first edition from 1899, the volume has a brief discourse on miracles within the discussion of the laws of nature in the treatise of natural philosophy. He did change the placement of the discussion of the laws of nature in later editions to the section in which the doctrine of providence is discussed, placing the analysis of miracles also within that section. Still, this movement might be evidence of the difficulty that Neo-Thomists found in discussing such an alien notion to the thought of Thomas Aquinas. There are several other instances of this kind of placement and discussion among 20th century Thomists. One may consider Edouard Hugon's Cursus Philosophiae Thomistica from 1903, which locates the treatment of miracles in the volume devoted to philosophy of nature, right after the section dedicated to how nature is governed through the laws of nature, with a minor mention of divine providence. Hugon does not refer to miracles in his theological books, or handbooks at least, right? Which is rather odd. Hugon. Similar placements are found in Stanislas Alfred Lorty's Elementa Philosophiae Christiana ad Mentem San Thomas Aquinati Expositio, that's the third edition somewhere there, who discusses miracles and the laws of nature long before the doctrine of providence. Albert Fodger's Philosophia Scholastica ad Mentem Sanctumae Aquinatis Exposita ad Recentoris Scientiarum Inventis Aptata, 1921. Yes, on the contrary, analyzes the subject long after the doctrine of providence, as does Michel de Maria, in his Philosophia Peripatetico Scholastica Ex Fontibus Aristotelis et Sanctumae Aquinatis from 1913. Tilman Pesch, Institutiones Philosophiae Naturalis Secundum Principia Sanctumae Aquinati, also does that. Carl, that's 1897. Cursus Philosophicus Philosophiae Naturalis from 1926. Or even Jean-Marie Aubert, Philosophie de la Nature, from 1965, also discussed miracles when discussing the laws of nature. Aubert is very short, but still does it. The earlier, heavily influential Spanish Juan José Urrábarru, in his Institutione Philosophicae, 8 very long volumes, starting in 1892, and even who was named one of the greatest, if not the greatest, of all Neo-Thomists of the 20th century, Reginald Garrigou-Lagrange, in his De Revelatione from 1950, also discussed miracles linked to their analysis of the laws of nature. So it's all over the place. What is perhaps most interesting of these scholars is that, to the best of my knowledge, only Hugon discusses the topic of miracles in direct relation to obediential potency in some depth, a key notion in Aquinas' own metaphysical understanding of the workings of a miracle. Hugon brings a short analysis of obediential potency together with the laws of nature to show that miracles are possible. Some other, Uraburu, Garrigou, Lorty, and Farget, mention the notion, but give a minor importance to it, with only Lorty and Uraburu mentioning it in relation to miracles in passing notes. Garrigou expands on obediential potency, but not in relation to miracles, but to spiritual life. So instead, all of them link their analysis of the possibility of miracles to the modern notion of the laws of nature in what might be read as an attempt to engage with the modern world of science, as Pope Leo XIII was inviting them to do. Still, one might wonder whether they gave up a bit too quickly into modern themes, disregarding the most important insight of Aquinas' analysis, namely that every creature depends in all its being upon the Creator. If my presentation of Aquinas' metaphysical analysis of the possibility of miracles is correct, the notion of God's interfering with nature would have to be rethought, even within Thomistic circles. This intervention or interference can no longer be conceived as breaking some unbreakable law of nature, or as suspending an order that cannot be suspended. God's so-called intervention in nature is, in this perspective, something completely intelligible and, Aquinas would theologically argue, almost necessary. But that's for Marius to tell us later tomorrow. It is intelligible, ultimately, because it is the order of nature that depends upon God and not God who depends upon the created order. And it is almost necessary since, eschatologically speaking, the goal of these miraculous interventions is human salvation, which for Aquinas cannot be attained only by human means and requires the divine power and an obedient creature. Thank you.